Can I have the dais, please? Thank you. House Revenue Committee for April 5th, 2017 will come to order. The colleagues, we're going to just take these bills in the order that we have them today. And so that means we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2942. Kyle is going to tell us all about it.
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2942, it does quite a number of things. It's a six-page bill, all of it's in bold language, so the SMS is rather long. I will try to hit the high points, and then if there's any follow-up questions, I can go into more detail. But the general concept of House Bill 2942, and there's a dash one amendment that I'll get to in just a second, is it imposes a new tax, and it's equal to 1.75% on the rental price of construction, mining, earth moving, or industrial equipment that's mobile and owned by a heavy equipment provider and held primarily for rental. So these are equipment providers that rent this heavy equipment. So it imposes a new tax, but on the other side, it would eliminate the property tax that's placed upon this type of property that is subject to the new rental tax. So you have a new tax put in place and eliminate the property tax burden. It does require quarterly returns, so it's these rental providers will submit returns quarterly basis to Department of Revenue. Department of Revenue will then, they can keep a little bit up to 3% for administrative costs, but they then disperse those funds received from the rental tax to the county treasurers that then disperse those funds more or less in an attempt in line with how the property taxes would be collected on that property. So they disperse it based upon the rental location and the receipts received from the rental property in the taxing districts in which the rental property exists. So in some sense, the attempt is by eliminating the property tax and putting in place a new tax, that new tax would cover the property tax receipts that are no longer collected. There is a mechanism in the first 2 years after the tax, the new tax goes in place, where Department of Revenue will estimate the amount of property taxes associated with the property that has been, that is now going to be exempted, compare that to the tax receipts that are received under the rental tax, and then if the tax receipts that come in under the rental tax are above the property tax liability, they would refund that difference. If the rental tax receipts are below the property tax liability, there would be a supplemental tax imposed upon the rental providers. And that's an attempt to, in a sense, hit that revenue neutral position with the tax. So if the tax rate's too low, a supplemental tax is imposed. If it's too high, then there's a refund back to the rental providers. That's in the first 2 years following the imposition of the new tax. There's also a requirement of DOR to produce a study, report back to the legislature, along with the Legislative Revenue Office, and then report on a new rate that could be imposed based upon the 2 years and what the data looks like at that point, if that 1.75% works, or if a new rate needs to be established that would hit that revenue neutrality. I think that's the general high points. The dash one makes it removes mining and earth moving equipment from the definition of heavy equipment providers, makes another few other modifications and clarifications to the bill as introduced.
Very good. Thank you. John McClelland and Ed Noonan, please.
Committee bill.
Sorry?
Committee bill.
Yes. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Just to introduce myself, I'm Ed Noonan with United Rentals.
My name is John McClelland. I'm the Vice President for Government Affairs at the American Rental Association. I'm also the Chief Economist.
Great. Thank you.
So if you two of us give some testimony, then we'll be available for comment or for questions.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Again, Ed Noonan with United Rentals. We are the largest equipment rental company. We have a significant presence here in Oregon. We have 10 locations in Coos Bay, Eugene, Hermiston, Medford, Portland, Roseburg, Salem, and Tigard. We have over 150 employees. This industry, certainly at the scale that it is today, one could argue we are really the first industry to be in the shared economy. And John will talk a little bit more about our industry here in a few minutes. As we are a relatively new industry, my company just started 20 years ago. Our business model does not fit well into the property tax laws of Oregon or in property tax laws generally. Our model is unique. A property is purchased for resale, it's rented, and then it's ultimately or subsequently sold. The rental fleet is not considered assets used in our business. They're considered a business input. The rental fleet is our widget, if you will. Some of the issues with the current assessment process include the fact that our property is very, very mobile, extremely mobile. And we take a snapshot for the property taxes and we say, okay, everything that's here right now, we're going to assess this and we're going to tax this as if it's going to be here for a whole year. So we'll pay a whole year's worth of tax. If that piece of equipment moves, maybe go out of the state, maybe sold before the end of the year, we're still paying that whole year's worth of tax. There's no proration of that tax. The other challenge is that this equipment is valued the same as if there was a single owner. And so the way the process works, there's really no allowances or any accommodations made for the excess wear and tear for this equipment. And if you think of a rental car, you know, 3-year-old rental car is going to be different than somebody that owns it as one owner for 5 or 6 years. So, you know, there's depreciation tables. There's one table for everything. Each piece of our equipment, we could probably file an appeal on with every single jurisdiction every year. It just wouldn't be cost beneficial to do that. And that's why you have the bill in front of you today. National policy organizations have passed resolutions urging states to recognize heavy equipment rental as a special type of inventory. Both ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and NCSL, National Conference of State Legislatures, have passed text resolutions calling for states to do two things. One, provide an exemption for all types of business inventory, and to define inventory broadly to include different forms of inventory, such as heavy equipment rental. Two, consider administrative accommodations or substitute taxes for taxpayers with highly mobile property that will be used in multiple locations within the state or in multiple states throughout the tax year, such as equipment rental. The conclusion is, although the language differs between the two organizations, the message is the same. States should define heavy equipment rental as inventory, and if a state can't eliminate the inventory tax, it should at a minimum provide relief for the heavy equipment rental industry. There are over 30 states today that either don't tax this equipment at all or have some alternative tax treatment as what we're seeking here today. Couple things, key points of what the bill does. The bill defines heavy equipment rental fleet as inventory and exempts the fleet from personal property tax. The bill provides for a replacement of the personal property tax with a rental rate of 1.75% to be collected on the rental transactions. This approach taxes the rental fleet on the economic activity it creates while here in the state of Oregon, which is a better capture mechanism for the tax. The bill provides for a 2-year true-up period to ensure local governments are made whole. This was put in to address concerns raised from local governments. The bill provides for a registration process for each qualified business with a DOR, which lessens the work on the assessors. This thoughtful, revenue-neutral approach creates a common-sense solution to a unique problem, and it follows sound tax policy adopted by many other states.
Thank you, Ed. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. As I said, my name is John McClellan. I'm Vice President for Government Affairs and Chief Economist at the American Rental Association. The rental industry is probably something before this legislation came up that most of you didn't know very much about, so let me just tell you a little bit about us. Mr. Noonan mentioned that United Rentals, which is our largest member, has been around for about 20 years. The American Rental Association was formed 61 years ago in Moline, Illinois, when 21 rental operators got together and decided that they needed to have an association to represent the equipment rental industry. At that time, almost all of the rental industry was what you might call mom-and-pop operations, single-store operations. But over the years, there's been a big evolution. Here in Oregon, there are 38 ARA members, and they're operating out of 68 locations. And we have almost 5,000 members worldwide in the ARA. About 4,000, a little bit more than 4,000, those are in the United States. Most of the rest in Canada, but we do have members in Europe and Japan and Brazil and Australia and other places like that. And the business model is pretty much the same. And I think Ed's exactly right. In recent years, you know, this whole idea of the sharing economy has been much more prevalent and has grown a lot. And I think that is one of the reasons that larger companies that specialize in the rental of heavy construction and industrial equipment has occurred. So we see that happening a lot. Now, one of the things that Mr. Noonan also mentioned is that this equipment is very mobile and our fleets are very, very dynamic. Equipment moves around, and well, Mr. Noonan made the rental car analogy. I'll make another rental car analogy. When you've gone in to rent a car recently, was it a 2005? I doubt it. It was probably a car that was no more than 2 years old in most cases. That's exactly the way that our fleets operate. And remember, you know, when these personal property taxes in many of these states were written, you know, the whole thinking behind those is that you have a building and you have machinery and it's put in there and it's bolted down to the floor, and so you know you know where that equipment is, you know what it's doing, you know what business it belongs to, all those other kinds of things. The reason that we don't fit very well into those laws is specifically because our equipment is mobile, it moves all over the place. And in the case of our national companies that have national or super regional footprints, and you have several of those operating here in Oregon, the state, the equipment also moves in and out the states. So and I think another point I'd like to make is that the bill before you really helps provide certainty for us. We have a very, very difficult time in figuring out what we charge for our equipment when we put it on rent so that these property taxes can be covered. And remember, they're based on a snapshot that is taken on a specific day. So the fleet is changes a whole lot throughout that year. And so we have to estimate how much property tax we're going to owe when it's time to pay, and it's very, very difficult. So we need that certainty, and that's one of the things that the bill before you helps provide is certainty for my members and being able to cover the property taxes that they owe on this fleet. So that's the reason that ARA supports the passage of 2942, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We're open for any questions.
Questions for this panel. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. So just some comments. What you're saying is that it's really difficult to assess the personal property tax as it relates to your industry because it's a moving target.
Mm-hmm. And precisely.
How many states do you currently have within American, within your company? You're in all 50 states, I assume?
My company is pretty much all 50 states, except for Hawaii.
Okay.
And there are ARA members in every U.S. congressional district, I'm certainly sure of.
Right.
And there may not be rental locations in every state senator or assembly district in Oregon. I'm not absolutely certain about that. But we're pretty ubiquitous.
Right.
Please, yes.
And obviously you have transfers between states. You
Correct.
Talk about equipment. You talk about from Portland to Vancouver,
Correct.
Portland to Boise, Portland to Sacramento,
yep.
that sort of thing, correct?
Yeah, and just to give you an example, when we talked before, I think we met with some of you folks individually to discuss this, the idea of tax pyramiding, you know, happens when if you take a piece of equipment that's here on the snapshot date and then it ends up being in Nevada in July, that's their snapshot date. Guess what? We get subject for tax there. So you get this tax pyramid and as this stuff moves across the country, and that's, you know, some of the concern and some of the problem.
Okay. One other follow-up,
Mr. Yes, Chair? Please. Uh-huh.
Thank you. So the definition in here of the companies in question are just heavy equipment renters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How would this apply to, let's say, a local rental yard that's not affiliated with a chain like you?
Mm-hmm.
Much smaller scale, but yet they rent heavy equipment as well. Where actually it's on the premises.
Right.
They own it and build a thing. Pretty much they have to part it out because it gets so worn out.
Yeah.
Different business model. Would this also apply equally there? Would this they not be covered by this bill?
I think it would cover most of those, but I think as Mr. McClellan mentioned, the a lot of those folks have similar issues. Even if they're only in the state or in two or three states, they're still going to move that equipment around. I don't know, John, if you want to...
I'm just talking about a specific location in a small, more rural community in Oregon that I think owns their stuff probably that they just have on the premises. They don't lend it out. They don't rent it out. They keep it there.
Oh, well, then, in other words, they're not a rental. They're not a rental company.
Well, they are, but they do all kinds of stuff from lawnmowers to heavy equipment to ladders to paint sprayers.
Oh, I understand. So you're saying that they're a general rental company.
But they still have backhoes and cats.
Right. Right. I think that under the classification code that's in the bill, 532412, the way the NAICS codes work is that so a company puts down their classification, and I believe it's really a self-reporting classification. So if a company like that felt like the preponderance of their business was from the rental of heavy equipment, even though they may have lawnmowers and small trenchers or light generators or something like that, that one wouldn't necessarily think of heavy equipment, they would qualify under the bill because they would have characterized themselves as a company under that NAICS code.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yes.
Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony today. Douglas Schmidt, please. Yes, please. Department 2.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. And I really just wanted to answer Representative Johnson's question a little bit more if I could.
Please.
The standard that's going to be set up, the bill, I think, as it's written now, says it's by NAICS code, but that's going to come out, is my understanding, in the -1 amendment. And it'll just be whether or not the company primarily leases heavy equipment as their business model. So with your folks, I think the question would really be, does more than 50% of their income come from the rental of the heavy equipment, or does more than 50% come from the ladders? And if they get pulled into this, then all of their rentals, including the smaller tools, would be taxed based off of the rental rate. And I think that's the answer to your question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. And here we are again. Thank you for coming.
Good to see everybody.
So often to testify here.
We should go on a picnic or something. Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, testifying for the Assessors Association. At this time, the assessors are still opposed to this bill. It's not so much from the overall administration of the bill, because a lot of that's going to be done by the Department of Revenue. They're going to have to do all of the tracking and the collection of the fees, distribution of the fees to the county, but there are some other concerns that we have that we still believe we need to oppose this. Basically, this bill moves tangible property out of the ad valorem property tax realm into a sales tax, rental tax basis. It creates a property tax exemption that assessors, we have no way to report in any of the tax expenditure reports. It's not clear how the bill resolves some of the underlying issues identified as being problematic. The mobility of the equipment is difficult to track. Well, it's still mobile, even if it's collecting a rental fee. The current system would cause double taxation if equipment moved to another state during the year. I kind of understand now that may not happen based on the comment that was made. If it was under a rental fee, it would be taxed here in January. If it moved just for the amount of the rental, the months, and then if it moved to Nevada in July, it'd be taxed there for whatever that was. So that may not be as much of an issue. The bill actually creates a dual reporting system for the rental companies. They're collecting a fee on their rental equipment, but they still have to report all the other personal property in their store to the county. The out-of-state heavy equipment rental companies that bring equipment into the state are still going to have to report under personal property. At this point, I haven't seen how assessors will be notified of what equipment is exempt under the rental fee and what equipment isn't. So if we go out to a job site, we won't know which is which. The tax is based on the store location, which is different than what it is now. It's taxed based on where the equipment is actually located in the county. And some counties will win, some will lose. As an example, I'm going to use Morrill County.
And you've given us an exhibit on that, haven't you?
Yes. I've given a couple exhibits. One is dealing with bonds, and the other one is dealing with the distribution of the taxes. So I'm not sure there's an example specifically for Morrill County. This is more of a, right now, United Rentals has equipment in Morrill County, but they don't have a United Rental store in Morrill County. They have $29,000 worth of property tax generated for the districts in Morrill County. With this bill, that would change, and it would only be taxed to where the store is located, which is in Umatilla County. So Umatilla County districts where the store is located would benefit. The districts in Morrill County would lose that revenue. They would lose it anyway when the equipment moved out. Okay, this would just create that sooner. So I'm not trying to say this won't happen. There's a concern about Department of Revenue getting a fee. Way to go. If the 1.75% doesn't include their fee, then the counties and districts won't be held harmless with this. They'd actually be collecting a little less revenue. The bond payments in this mechanism will actually be paid twice. If the equipment is moved out of the ad valorem property tax system and the bonds were determined right now that bond payment would go, it's still going to be collected. Okay, it has to be collected. So that's going to be diverted to some of the other taxpayers. Plus, in their distribution amount that they talk about, it doesn't exclude bonds. It just talks about it's every taxing district within where that store is located. So depending on where the store is located and everything, there could be some bond payments that are paid twice. If it's an out-of-county store, then it wouldn't be that impactful.
So if just to interrupt for a moment, I think what you've just said is that if this comes off the property tax roll, the assessor will still assess the cost of the bonds against all the other taxpayers, mm-hmm. which will increase the rate at which other taxpayers will pay.
That's correct.
And then in addition to that, this fund would be expected to pay its proportional share of the bond cost, and that's where you get double. The other taxpayers pick up the second piece, I think.
The Chair Barnhart,
If I understood you correctly, the other taxpayers will pay a little bit more within each.
The district right. where that bond was issued, yes, they will pick that up when this revenue is gone. Now, again, it's not to say that equipment isn't going to be gone at some point, so that would shift to them. Okay, this would just make that happen a little quicker.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to make certain I understood what the point was.
Well, and I wasn't sure I was explaining it clear, Chair Barnhart.
Please go ahead.
One other point. I did mention that at this point we don't know what equipment is exempt and what is taxable as far as heavy equipment. So that would need to be corrected. And it does appear that the distribution on this would not be the normal distribution of the funds. And there is an exhibit for that. It talks about the distribution on this is...
Is that the one you've called 2016-2017 tax rates by code area?
Yes, and on the right side in the box is the distribution. Okay. It says the distribution shall be based on the ratio that each taxing district's total tax rate for purposes of ad valorem property taxation bears to the total tax rates for all districts in which a rental location is located. So that basically limits it to the distribution to the taxing districts where the where the store is located. And that's not how distribution percentages are calculated. They're calculated based on the total revenue from each district and against the total revenue that's generated in the county. And that distribution then is used throughout all distributions. So that is something that those specific districts will get some additional revenue that maybe wouldn't be inside the normal distribution percentage. I'm going to make a recommendation or a suggestion to keep this process under the property tax system and reporting. Maybe work with Department of Revenue to get some better depreciation tables that better represent rental equipment versus owned equipment that has a higher use and depreciation. But if the taxpayer, this won't solve the dual taxing if it's moved out of the county, but if a taxpayer or the business that rents the equipment was required to report where their equipment was as of January 1st, then that would take out the trying to find out where that equipment is moved to, because one of the problems is that they rent to a business, and that business could have multiple job sites around the state or even out of state. So if the person renting the equipment was required to report that, or if there's GPS tracking on the equipment, report it based on where the GPS tracking device said it was. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair, I just want to get back to the definition of qualified heavy equipment, and as I see it in Section 1, it means any construction, mining, earth moving, or industrial equipment, together with attachments, equipment, tools, not limited to towable trailers, fixed load trailers, that is mobile, owned by the provider, held primarily for rental. But under this definition, a jackhammer or a paint sprayer would also be in here because it's mobile, can also be used on construction. Is there a better definition somewhere? I mean, are we talking about horsepower, gross vehicle weight? I mean, I know what's in view here, but I don't think the definition is refined enough to know exactly what would be eligible for, you know, this taxation.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, from the way I understand the bill, it is intended to be that if the majority or primary purpose of the rental store is heavy equipment,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the Department of Revenue and the industry would maybe have to better define that, because that's going to be their decision.
Right.
Okay, they will be deciding that so that it can be, so the tax can be handled. But yes, if you have a jackhammer, and it's also ancillary equipment that would go with that heavy equipment. So you may need a portable starter or something to go with a large Caterpillar or something that would also be exempt.
Yeah, maybe other states have a better handle on this. I don't know. But it just looks to me like it's pretty going to be difficult to know exactly what you're shooting at here. There's a lot of extraneous app tools and devices that go along with the actual heavy equipment itself sometimes.
Sure. And if I may, Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, I think that part of what was intended with the way that the definitions work now is that it would make things easier on us if all the equipment at the facility were treated one way or the other, because otherwise you'd get into a situation where the assessor is supposed to do property taxes on certain smaller equipment, and the taxpayer is supposed to report the rental tax on the larger equipment. And so what we wanted it to be is that basically it's an all or nothing deal. So if more than half of your money is generated through, and I get your point about mm-hmm. what the rental of what exactly, but if more than half of your income is generated through the rental of that equipment, then everything in your store pays based off of this system. Now, that's not the shelving. That's not the computers. It's not the registers. That stuff you're still going to pay personal property tax on. But basically, if it's something that you rent out, that would be no longer under property tax. It would be exempted as inventory, and then you would pay this other tax instead. And we worked quite closely with the bill sponsors on the definition. It was going to be NAICS code at the outset, and our concern is, as it was described, that's a self-reported thing, the NAICS code. And they may have a separate NAICS code for a federal operation, right, like you think of a Shell Oil. In Oregon, they're a gas station, but nationwide, they're an oil refiner. So they have two different NAICS codes, arguably. And then we looked around statewide. Does anybody actually verify these NAICS codes? And we don't. You can put any code on your tax return that you want to. And so it would be a, it would just be kind of a pick your own exemption. So what we wanted to do instead was go with this primary. And I understand that it's not perfect, but that's kind of how we got there.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I do want to say that assessors have been in contact with the sponsors of this bill. They have changed the bill, some of that, to help us to make it clearer. So I don't want to make it sound like they haven't been willing to work with assessors on this. It's just that we still have a few concerns on this bill.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2942 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2243. Chris.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2243 pertains to the e-commerce tax credit. To refresh your memory, it is an investment tax credit that is equal to 25% of the eligible investment. What House Bill 2243 does, it does three primary things. It moves the sunset date to 6 years. It increases the number of electronic commerce zones from 15 to 21, equally over 3 years. And then it modifies the tax credit with respect to refundability and the carry forward. Under current law, it is not refundable. Any amount unused in a given year can be carried forward for up to 5 years. This bill provides the option for the taxpayer to take 80% of that excess credit as a refundable credit instead of a carry forward. So it kind of creates a hybrid tax credit that may be refundable or carried forward. It also does require some additional reporting information by the potential claimant on past use of tax credits when they file for the property tax exemption. And it also allows the public reporting of information on the use of the tax credit. And in all this, you have the fiscal and the revenue from the prior committee. They're both just light statements. And then you also have in all this the relevant pages from the tax credit report on the enterprise zones. That section does include the two other credits. So on about the fourth page of that document is the discussion on the enterprise zone, the electronic commerce zone tax credit.
Okay, thank you. We have three people signed up. Oh, yes, Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. Just a question before we get going. I'm aware of two personal tax credits that are refundable, the child care tax credit and the low-income tax credit. Do we have business tax credits that are refundable at this point?
There was one credit that was refundable. I think that might be it.
So this is sort of new territory in the wild world of tax credits.
Well, there was one credit that was refundable for certain kinds of taxpayers and not for others, and I'm forgetting which one that is. DOR is in the room. They may recall offhand. This is kind of new for... it is new territory to take a credit that the taxpayer will have the option, and then part of it would be refundable.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. We have three people who've signed up to testify today. Art Fish, Andy Reid, and Wendy Johnson, please.
Well, good afternoon to you, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith, Warner, and Bentz, and members of the committee. My name is Art Fish with Business Oregon, and I'm happy to be here. I appreciate your taking the time to hear this bill, for which the executive branch is, asking for your favorable consideration. Before I get going, I did want to know, I think the one other refundable credit out there is wolf depredation. Oh, it did it? Yeah. My bad. All right. Well, House Bill 2243 deals with, you know, this existing and increasingly useful investment tax credit that's based on 25% of the cost of capital assets used in internet-based transactions, customer support, order fulfillment, et cetera, by businesses in only 15 of the 69 enterprise zones. So in a sense, it inherently has these sideboards. It's fairly, you know, narrowly circumscribed incentive, you know, compared at least to the investment tax credits commonly found in other states. But it is, you know, among the very few income tax-related incentives available for economic development. It is perhaps our very best tool in that regard. Granted that, you know, we don't have a lot related to income taxes in this respect. The credit, as it started out, and one of the ways to kind of keep it administratively efficient and stuff was that it piggybacked off the enterprise zone standard program, or the exemption on new qualified property that is allowed for 3 to 5 years on businesses. And these businesses need to add a certain number of jobs, they need to file, they need to do all these things. So in effect, you know, by piggybacking off of that property tax program and sort of doing a layering of the thing, the income tax credit also picks up on those sideboards that go with the enterprise zone program, in addition to, you know, not being allowed in all the enterprise zones and stuff. I think Chris touched on all the things that the bill would do, most notably of which, of course, is to extend the sunset within the usual 6-year cycle that has been set forth. So, you know, this is nothing, we're not ahead of the schedule here at all. It would expand. Over time, we start out with just 4 of these overlays with enterprise zones. 6 were added in 2006 or 7, and 5 last just a few years ago in 2014. The bill would add 6 more, 2 each over 3 years, starting in 2018. Because we do have, and I think Wendy Johnson will comment on some of the areas that are liking to get one of these. It would also provide for greater reporting, and it provides a specific concrete way to get at direct public data about the credit. I mean, you know, any amount of transparency really needs to begin with thinking about the actual good collection and management of data, and this is a method to get there, as well as some related tightening up of some of the administrative and clawback type provisions. You know, again, the reporting would be done with the enterprise zone, so we would continue to piggyback off of some of the existing tools out there with the filing of the property tax claims. And finally, it would enhance the effectiveness of the program, or that's what it proposes to do, hopefully to make it a more viable incentive or inducement for smaller businesses by, again, an 80% refund in lieu of any carry forward. And we would agree with our colleagues at the Department of Revenue that that should be, you know, an irrevocable choice by the taxpayer. You know, and we've looked at this, and we've analyzed it. We've worked on the tax expenditure report with Revenue and with Chris and Legislative Revenue Office on the Sunset Report, relying, you know, at present on the less direct data available through the property tax system, again, in the filings there. And, you know, we allude to it a little bit in our testimony, but just to give you a little more detail, you know, we looked at all, you know, and again, on page 38 of the Sunset or Tax Credit Sunset Report is some data based on that from just the investments or projects that started their property tax abatement just this past year of 2016. We looked at all the exemptions of fairly recent ilk that, you know, were still in effect in 2016 over the 3 to 5 year period. The total of new jobs in association with those was about 2,400, 2,500 of existing jobs involving $662 million in investment, and over about a 10-11 year period, the property tax effect of that or impact is on the order of $20.3 million. Looking at the legislative revenue estimates for the income tax over, you know, essentially the same kind of 12-year, very long period, that would be about 19.2. We then estimated, based on the jobs, using a very flat wage trajectory, only effectively counting half of the jobs or half of the wages, doing present value discounting, and only going over 6 years with those numbers, we estimated the personal income tax associated with that very conservatively based on all those things. That alone was 40% of that combined income tax and property tax impact that I just alluded to. And I think if we did a full economic impact analysis of that, you know, you could readily find a 2.5 multiplier that would get you all the way. The multiplier would relate to part-time jobs that we're not really counting directly, temp jobs, retained jobs, and especially your indirect and what are called induced effects with the spending that goes on by the new jobs and so forth, and, as well as construction and vendors and so forth. In addition to that kind of economic payback or return, you also have the property taxes or the additions to the property tax base that can be realized after the 3 to 5 year exemption on that property, which has been studied in the past and does provide some degree of also greater confidence in payback. And then just getting into more of the policy, I mean, you have with this, a catalytic effect. You had some synergy between using the property tax abatement, which may or may not mean that much to certain businesses, with the income tax credit, but also you get this effect by targeting a certain niche here. It's a fairly narrow target, but it's an evolving field of opportunity. We have lots of businesses out there that are engaged in e-commerce in sort of unique and interesting ways. This is a fairly evolving field. And I'll list a little bit about that. We've seen a certain degree of what people have called clustering. The more technical term is agglomeration within industries in certain parts and some of that effect. And finally, I just note that, these are enterprise zones. Another piggyback element here is that these are areas with some local, sometimes fairly pocketed economic distress in urban areas, to be sure. But we would hope with additional zones that many more of those would be in more rural settings. But I think these types of businesses do provide a great variety of skill sets and opportunities for people in various wells. So, again, I'm very pleased that we have Andy Reid here from Portland Development Commission, a local zone manager who deals with a lot of these. I think he has more direct experience. I have lists and I talk to people all the time, but it's a growing enterprise zone system, so I'm not as in touch with things as I wished I were. But I would just note some of the sectors at least that are engaged in this. And we have online services, which also would involve a lot of intangible sales, things that aren't necessarily going to benefit much from the single sales factor, for one thing. E-tailing or sort of traditional order fulfillment and stuff, financial service centers, healthcare, customer support, gaming. We have Riot Games in within a data center, colo data center within Hillsboro. Manufacturing, I think Andy has a few examples of those. And then, corporate, the Daimler headquarters center and so forth. So, with that, I'll be happy to answer your questions and hopefully come up with more examples. But with that, I just turn it over to Andy. But I'm here all week to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Art. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, first of all, thank you for having us here today. My name is Andy Reid. I am the manager of the Portland Enterprise Zones, Portland and East Portland. First one was set up in 1986. The most recent one in East Portland was 2012. So we have two zones we run. I'm here in support of the extension of the authorization of the e-commerce program, as well as the increase of the number of statewide overlays. It's a tool that we have benefited from in the city, and we believe our other jurisdictions around the state could also see some use from it. We at the city and PDC have not taken a position on the refundability portion of the bill. We don't have enough, I think, information to make comments on at this point in time on those. So the kind of at a higher level, the Enterprise Zone program, it really is our best tool in economic development in the city of Portland. It's what we use to attract small, medium, and large businesses to come to Portland as well as grow in Portland. And really, I think grow has been where we've seen the majority of our activity, and I can talk about some of those projects here in a bit. We use this to leverage and maintain our economic competitiveness across as a state of Oregon with other states and also across the world. It really is a creator of high quality jobs. Currently, we have more than 55 companies that are using the Enterprise Zone program in the Portland zones. Our average pay is right around $28 an hour with another $11 an hour benefits on top of it. So these are really getting to those middle wage jobs that we really do want to see grow in the Portland area and across the state. In Portland specifically, we've seen about $900 million of investment in construction, manufacturing equipment, and so on. And last year alone, companies spent $91 million within the city of Portland on local procurement. So it really is having a significant impact in our local part of the market. Regarding the overlay itself, the e-commerce overlay, as we call it, software in Portland is one of our target clusters. This is a tool that allows us to attract them. Really, they can put those jobs anywhere. And we're seeing that there is that option for companies to, they can go to Dublin, they can go to Florida, they can go to wherever they want. And so it gives them the incentive to locate those jobs in Portland. Really, e-commerce, as Art was referring to, it is becoming the future. It is the future of today. Every company has some element of e-commerce that's getting built into their systems, and we want to make sure that as we are supporting our companies, that there is a tool that we can use to say, grow your e-commerce operation, bring revenue into the city, into the state, and ship your product or your goods or services out. And that really is the goal of that tool for us from our perspective. This tool also allows us to work with smaller companies that are interested in making the leap into e-commerce transactions. An example of this would be a company that is growing in Portland, Olympia Provisions. You may have had some of their food before in their now, I think, 5 restaurants in the Portland area. They are also getting their product into a number of different retailers, primarily Whole Foods being the bulk of where they're shipping their product to. And that's a big deal because that's a nationwide distribution. And so this is, I was just talking with the owner the other day, and she said the e-commerce has been a big piece of them. Again, every penny counts as they're growing their business. This was something that they referred to, and we were talking about it. Another small example, if you want to call it small, Schmidt Natural Deodorant. Not sure if you've ever heard of it before. They're now beginning to compete with Tom's of Maine, and they manufacture right in Portland in Airport Way. Small company again. Going to be growing significantly. They're going to be using the e-commerce tool as well. So there's two examples of manufacturers in the Portland area that are going to be tapping into this as a resource. And then last, really, e-commerce companies, they are job generators. They account for about 25% of the jobs that have come into the Portland market in the E-Zone program recently. Companies such as Jaguar Land Rover, RenTrak, Simple Finance, Treehouse, Viewpoint Construction Software, Cascade Energy. Some of them you may have heard of, some maybe you haven't. And they're really, these companies are really leading the standards in coming up with, kind of looking at the view of kind of corporate social responsibility. I'm just hearing from these companies that they want to do good by their employees as well as by the residents of our city. And so they're signing agreements and they're going into different agreements to work on hiring locally from the communities that have been kind of hit most or kind of left behind. And so I think in conclusion, we'll just leave it there, that this is a bill that we strongly support and be glad to answer questions as you have them.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm doing double duty today. Rocky Dellen wasn't able to stick around. He's the lobbyist for OEDA and the OEDA chair of the Government Relations Committee of OEDA is with the governor, touring one of these e-commerce sites and was not able to make it as well. So you have on OLIS his letter. Chad Freeman is both the president of SEDCOR, the local Strategic Economic Development Corporation that's here in Marion and the neighboring counties. And then OEDA represents or is a member organization that the League of Oregon Cities is actually a member of as well. OEDA is the Oregon Economic Development Association, and it has both private and public members who are really economic professionals who work across the state. And so OWIDA supports this bill as well, which extends the e-commerce zones. Right now, as you know from the bill, there are only 15 zones. This bill would allow you to allow the state to have two more per year. On OLIS from Business Oregon, you have a list of where all the e-commerce zones are right now. And then if you look at that list, there, many of them are in the urban areas, in Beaverton, Bend, Portland, Hillsboro. But there are a few. There's one in Bend. There's one in Hermiston, Rogue, near Grants Pass, and in the Springfield community. Then if you go to the next page, there are a whole bunch more cities who are interested, or counties that are interested in this. And it's working. As my colleagues explained, that this tool is bringing in jobs. And so if it's working, we don't want to stop it. And we'd like to see it, especially in the parts of the states that are really struggling economically. We see e-commerce as the future, as was said already. And so there are sideboards on this. It's capped at $2 million. You can only take off 25% of your costs of the investment. And so it has those sideboards. Plus, to even be eligible, you have to be part of the property tax e-zones. And so we've done our due diligence as a community to make sure that it's worth that investment as well. So we just think this is a program that works, that it's a futuristic look at how do we get businesses here. And so for those reasons, we support the bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for being here. I know I've spoken with a couple of you individually about this. I have a process question about the jobs requirement. I have also been working with Business Oregon on a bill about the Secretary of State's audit and kind of how best to implement some of those suggestions, and that's been a great productive conversation. And one of the things that's come up in that is the difficulty that Business Oregon has in being able to report on jobs produced specifically because of privacy issues with the employment department, a variety of things. So I guess my question is, it's great to have that in here as a sideboard, but my concern is this is a requirement in a lot of these programs, yet I'm also getting, you know, yet some of the feedback that we're getting is, oh, but we can't actually give you that information because of privacy concerns and because of issues internally. So can you make me feel any more assured that we would indeed be able to publicize that, like to track that job creation and actually report on it if this were passed?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Vice Chair Smith Warner, yes, I think I can hopefully make you happy here. To the audit, first of all, it does kind of span a variety of things. And the questions there with confidentially and job numbers relates to some of the administered programs within the agency that we rely directly. I mean, and it has great advantages on the UI tax data, payroll tax data that comes from the employment department. Providing, you know, we have to keep a very tight lid on that, how it can be related. It can be publicized with aggregation or other things, but that's for entirely different types of programs. With the enterprise zones, there's trade-offs. It's a very decentralized program. It's one of the things we've tried to impress in the aftermath of the audit is that, you know, we've been chipping away at trying to make it better, and Department of Revenue has done an outstanding job of putting a lot of the data that funnels up from the county assessors very much online. You know, it's self-reported, so it's very much available. It's not always perfect. There are gaps. And, you know, we have to try to, you know, get some counties have turnover in staff and those sorts of things. But we have very good overall employment numbers, and we've used those quite productively for analysis and evaluation. What the bill would do, I think for the enterprise zones, the property tax exemptions, and then insofar as those relate to some of these e-commerce businesses, I think we have a very good handle, you know, within, you know, 100 jobs or maybe of what's actually out there, and know a lot about the individual companies and how they're meeting their requirement, because they have to report on how many they have and then annually report on how much they have achieved on average each year of the exemption. And that needs to be 110% of where they started or more. And so, I mean, we see that found out, and I know Andy could speak to our work between him and the Multnomah County assessor on a regular basis. Gets a little busier in Multnomah County than some places, so that's really, I think, actually good experience. The bill would actually only open up the door to some of the income tax numbers. We can't get to the, I mean, you know, some people can look at it, but we can't get to the actual income tax credits that people are claiming. That's tax return numbers, not just exempt from disclosure, but confidential under penalty of felonies to release it. This bill would get around that. It's a workaround, in effect, through the statute to have them at least indicate how much maybe they're getting out of this tax credit specifically as part of their property tax filing. So, you know, it would be a full new addition, and it would be fully public, which is like the job numbers as good as the, you know, for what, you know, as good as they are for the enterprise zones already. Does that help? And I would, you know, welcome if Andy could comment on what we do with some of the employment numbers.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith Warner, yes, we watch things very closely. The county, Multnomah County, and PDC work hand in hand receiving the exemption claim forms, double checking them, and being proactive when we have a company that we're concerned is not meeting their obligations. Something pops up in the news, you know, you hear about things, we're on the phone right away making sure that the company is actually still keeping the jobs that they committed to. So we take it very seriously, and have had a number of disqualifications because of business decisions where companies have chosen to stop a line or do something, and there's a clawback of taxes as a result of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. So I guess I'm disturbed when I look at the research report in the first line under Electronic Commerce Enterprise Zone says, statute does not contain a specific purpose statement for this tax credit, which is a dramatic concern to me if we're using tax credits to try to spur certain kinds of policy. It's wonderful to hear that you feel like it's working in Portland. Portland is not, generally speaking, our biggest problem economically across the state. So I'm wondering, if we were to establish new e-commerce zones, what would be the parameters that you would use to evaluate where those go?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Marsh. First of all, I mean, the bill would provide us with more data. I mean, I think, you know, I think we often forget that there's this important thing, you know, and in the world of smart incentives and stuff, you know, we start with the idea, how can we get some better data and align it with our goals? Again, what it's, you know, the statement, and it's repeated in the tax expenditure report about a lack of a purpose statement. You know, again, there's been some question about whether those belong in statute or where they're going to be parked. But in the past committee where this bill was at, you know, the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade, we provided some text, and we're happy to see that that gets, you know, put out there as sort of a purpose statement, so that, you know, you have, what you have when you do that is you have some sort of fulcrum, again, in which you can start with as far as some of the analysis. Again, with a lot of these purpose statements, again, they only tell you a little bit of what you probably already guess at of why you're doing this. And so, you know, but hopefully they provide that articulation. And I think we provided that, and we're happy to provide it again to this committee. But, you know, how that gets put on the record, I'm not exactly sure. It's part of something that's supposed to be done now with every new tax credit. I think there's some disagreement with legislative council and other parties about exactly how to enshrine that, so to speak. But we would consider that as a, you know, what we've prepared as a good basis for, further evaluation of these down the road. And are they not only creating some jobs and doing some of this payback and, you know, some basic metrics and that sort of thing, like I've tried to explain here. But also, are we getting some more regional, local effects? And, you know, Andy's here because he's available, and he offers a great deal of experience. But I don't mean to say that there aren't examples like what he mentioned throughout the state already, and that if we went into rural areas, I don't know if we'd have the sheer impact. I don't expect to have the same number of jobs or the same amount of tax revenue impact, needless to say, either. But I hope that we could show that, you know, we're doing something. It's a little hard. I mean, you know, nothing in the economic or incentive world works on its own. It's all a matter of adding factors together. and, you know, broadband and amenities and all these other things that companies need to consider locally are very important. So, I mean, that's you know, we can't solve it all for rural Oregon. But I think with areas that have some potential, like we've seen in Jackson County especially, as well as the central Oregon area, you know, you can use this as an important tool. And so, you know, and I, you know, the thing that Wendy alluded to that Rocky would have talked to, and or before him, Chad Freeman, I'm sorry, is actually out in Independence. And, you know, and that's been a great opportunity. They converted an old shopping mall into this call center.
But the question had to do with purpose.
Yes.
And I think we're wandering a bit off of that.
Yeah, I know.
Now.
But I got to that.
I think Chris had an additional comment on this question, then we'll get the next one.
I think to your question, the issue with the policy purpose, in my 10 years here, we've been looking for the best way to do that. And as part of what you just heard, there is a question of where is the appropriate place for a purpose statement to be? Is it in statute or not? And what we've been doing in legislative revenue is we've been tacking that on to the revenue impact statements. For the credits or any tax expenditure, actually, as they move through the process. And we will come up with draft language, submit that to committee, and try to get that as part of the normal lexicon, if you will. And with the tax credit review process, that function is we're trying to get it out to the policy committees to refine the purpose statement, because that really does set the stage for any future analysis. As I think most people understand. So we still are on the revenue impact statements is where that is showing up these days.
Right. Please, yes.
To follow up, Mr. Chair, thank
please.
You.
Please.
In effect, though, if we expand the zones, we are enacting policy. We are making decisions to put those zones down, in effect, to achieve some sort of policy that's sort of inherent in the selection of the site. So, Mike, to go back to the second part of my question, which I don't think we got addressed, is what, given the ambiguity, the need to guess and assess, and, you know, the challenges over policy, how would you choose?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Marsh, I think if I'm understanding, maybe if we have these additional zones available or overlays and the credit continues and they're worth having. And I should note that that's not the only way overlays become available for other enterprise zones. Whenever a zone underlying zone terminates, we have to go through a process of figuring that out and where they go. And again, I would stand by our articulation that we provided to the last committee as the basis for a good purpose statement and whatever. And I think we would continue to apply that sort of thing going forward as far as trying to understand and evaluate these new zones. Right now, however, in contrast to the past, where we would do we would have sort of a competition and applicants for them would apply based on certain criteria that we laid out in administrative rule. Right now, the statute calls for us to make a referee a first-come, first-served process. So it's a little bit self-selective as far as the local zone sponsors that most want this. And that's about the best we can do. And we don't really have any ability to necessarily direct where these new overlays might end up.
Please.
If that's germane to your
like
question.
That feels like a problem to me. Well,
I think it is germane.
Other kind of discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just a quick comment. We discussed exactly this issue this morning in my office, and it did seem to me that it was a very strange process, that it basically was who got in line first.
Yeah.
And of course, your suggestion implied, I think, in your question, is that if we have a robust purpose statement, it becomes a lot easier for us to ask the department to actually evaluate the different proposals based on the purpose statement, rather than simply taking them on the basis of time. Then, of course, I don't think this bill actually goes into that at all, does it?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, that was a function really of a bill that passed in 2015.
Right, and it's not in this bill at all.
Yeah, and so we didn't think to get into that. This is real. The bill's pretty much just focused on the tax credit and where it might be used more.
Right, but of course the operation of the tax credit
Correct.
And the value of the tax credit may be dependent upon which projects are
chosen. Or zones.
Or which zones are chosen.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony. That's everybody, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2243 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2409. And Mazin has that one. I'll simply note that this is comes from the Judiciary Committee that we don't often get bills from. Mazin, why is this bill here, and what do we need to do with it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you, as you mentioned, from the Judiciary Committee, where they looked at the issues of the red light radar or slash radar combination type of things. And why is this important to you these days? We used not to actually very much pay attention to these type of bills. However, in the 2011 session, a couple of bills have passed, 7210 and 7212, House bills that are, that have kind of changed the complexions of how we do criminal fines and assessments and so on. And the way these things work these days, as it happened, that every fine, every citation that comes through either city, county, or the state courts has a certain amount of money that comes off the top to the criminal fines assessment account, which at the end filters to the general fund. So as the last session, we also were looking at some of the bills for the proposals of the City of Portland. We learned that these things could actually become a very effective money. It might not be at the end a lot of money net of expenses to the cities themselves, but as far as the general fund and the state is concerned, that is brings an amount of money that is worth looking at. So for that, we thought we need to learn about this process, learn more of how many cities, what kind of ideas, so we would know how to be able to evaluate how much of this revenue that is coming to the state, how is these things are going to work. And it is basically because it is something new that we're learning, we thought we'll bring it to the committee in front of you, ask the cities and the different parts of the people and the sections right. interested with this to look at it and tell us more, educate us about this process.
Thank you very much. Jim Munger, Scott Winkles, and Elizabeth Edwards, please. We happen to have three sign-ups and three seats, so. While they're getting settled, I'd ask staff if there's anything in the exhibit list that just talks about the revenue issues that you've raised. I don't. A quick look. I don't see anything.
I think, Mr. Chair, the
maybe the revenue impact statement.
The revenue. Yeah.
Maybe that's it. Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chairs Bentz and Smith Warner, members of the committee. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of you today. For the record, my name is Jim Monger. I'm the Chief of Police for the Beaverton Police Department, and I appreciate your consideration of House Bill 2409A. The City of Beaverton is proud of the range of bill supporters that include the League of Cities, Individual Cities, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Street Trust, and also Oregon Walk. We are very committed to any effort that decreases the likelihood of fatalities or serious injuries that are the result of excessive speeding. A 2000 data review by the U.S. Department of Transportation showed that the chances of a serious injury or fatality for pedestrians increased from 40 to 80% when a vehicle travels 10 miles per hour over a posted speed limit in a 30-mile-an-hour zone. Over the last year, more than 90,000 trips through Beaverton's four red light camera intersections were more than that 10-mile-an-hour posted limit. This poses a significant danger to pedestrians, cyclists, and also other drivers. The danger from speed is true regardless of whether the light is green, red, or yellow. And including tools like red light camera systems are an effective way of changing behavior and slowing speeds. Currently, the ability to issue citations through the red light statute is limited to evidence shown by the camera alone, which does not in and of itself capture the actual speeding. Photo radar statutes focus on speeding, but do not cover the red light camera systems. This leaves a gap in the ability to ensure safer streets through effective public education and enforcement of excessive speed in intersections. Many red light camera systems already include pavement sensors or other technologies that captures the speed of each vehicle, such as the systems in Beaverton. That is how we were able to determine the 90,000 trip figure over the past year. House Bill 2409A makes modest changes to the existing red light camera statutes, ORS 810, 434, 435, and 436.
And if you could focus on the issue that this committee is yes. most likely to be interested in, and that has to do with the revenue implications. I'm assuming, and I think that I'm hoping the committee will agree with me, that the Judiciary Committee has already vetted the issue that you're raising, that you're talking about now. This is not an area of our expertise. We're working with revenue and the implications of this change for revenue purposes. So if you could skip ahead
Absolutely.
To that part.
I just flipped my page, so I'm ready to
that
go
That would
there.
Be helpful. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes. So as far as that, I want to kind of set down the number of citations or the number of vehicles through those four intersections. And in Beaverton, our count was 90,000. Now, that's all trips through. The photo radar system or the photo red light camera systems have not every citation that goes through is actually issued. And when you peel away the images that are not usable, mismatch genders, obstructed license plates, and then you go further into the citations that are actually issued, and some folks are able to go to the certificate of innocence, which is basically the it wasn't me document, and they're able to get those dismissed. Of that 90,000, and Chair, I believe I'm getting to your point now, that 90,000 actually gets down to a citation count of about a third of that number, so about 30,000 of those citations. So when it comes to the dollar amount using the fines there, and again, that amount of violations through, the vast majority are at that 10-mile-an-hour or over. When they get into that 20-mile-an-hour, it's less than 4%, so it's not a great number there. So using the 90,000, getting down to 30,000 citations, the money side of things is that the distribution would be about $1.37 million to the state, less than $500,000 to the county, and the remainder to the city general fund in this case, which would be $3.12 million. Now, another point that I want to make on that, though, is the judge on the bench has the opportunity to reduce the fine amount, and that fine amount is not impacted to the state or to the county. That impacts the amount that is actually going to the city, so that would reduce that particular amount. I apologize, I don't have that particular amount, but usually those citations can be dismissed by about 25%. So it's a significant amount when you're talking that $3.17 million. Chair, I hope that more likely answered your question about what you were looking for, sir.
Yeah, I hope so as well. Yes, sir, please. Sorry, were there other questions? Yeah, Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, acknowledge.
We're getting into your area, aren't we?
Speeding?
No. Ways and means. Ways and means.
I appreciate that. I guess I have a revenue question. Of the 90,000 trips, actually, as I read the legislation, it talked about that in order for a citation to be issued, a police officer would need to review the footage and issue a citation. Give me your best estimate, or this committee's best estimate, of the 90,000 trips through Beaverton's four red light camera intersections that were traveling at excessive speeds. How many citations do you think that officer who would be reviewing these would issue?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Smith, as far as that 90,000, as far as the actual citations through, it would probably be closer to about 45,000. The first screening happens with the vendor, and those are the ones that take a look at the images and will decide which ones will go further on. So about half of them are going to go before the officer to evaluate those. So the volume there would be about 45,000 up to about 45,000 citations annually.
So you anticipate everyone that's reviewed and in excess would receive a citation?
No. After that, well, let me back that up. In excess, yes. And so that would be that about that 49%. And then from there, the number reduces by about 20% of those are able to go to the certificate of innocence. And then that drops down to that 30% or 33% that actually would be subject to paying a fine.
So the 45,000, approximately 33% would be issued a citation?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, but, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in support of 2409. Currently, there are only a handful of cities that actually utilize red light technology. I believe it's currently there are nine cities that are using cameras. I believe Grants Pass is in the process, is in the RFP process of adding them as well. Each of those cities submits a report to the legislature outlining the use of the cameras. And so we have some data that we can share. The challenge is that not every camera, not every city is tracking speeding through the intersection, which this is addressing. So what I can tell you is that if in the city of Tualatin's case, they took, in 2016, they took 15,190 tickets, of which 4,363 citations were issued. I'm going to caution on that number. Because a citation was issued doesn't mean that the state was paid, so it would have gone to court. Right. There are serious collections issues among some courts because we're typically using a private collection agency. Cities don't have the same suite of collections options that the circuit court uses. Not to step on my colleague's toes, but in the city of Portland, they ran their auditor's report, they ran a 5-year average, and they were looking at about 26,000 photographs being taken per year in the city of Portland's camera system, and they issued somewhere around 10,000 citations with 7,200 citations paid or partially paid. Portland and Gresham are both going to have a higher collections rate than other jurisdictions because Portland's and Gresham citations go to circuit court where they have the full.
Excuse me just a moment. Representative Bats?
Right, and to ask, I forgive me if you've been asked this a dozen times before, but whether it's going to be a device that makes us safer or a device that just collects money is the question. So are you about to tell us that there's been a precipitous drop in the number of red light violations since this policy was instituted, or can we sit here and rely upon this as a steady income stream because it's really a taxing device as opposed to a safety device?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bentz, the device, what typically happens is that you will see a spike in violations, and then there will be a decrease, and then that tends to steady off. What I would say, looking at the intersections that are being used, it depends somewhat on where the device is placed. If it's a high degree of local traffic, then the citations tend to drop off more precipitously. Also, the process in which a camera is cited doesn't simply involve the police department. It involves transportation, and they typically what the city will do is determine if the crashes are occurring because because of red light running, because you might have an intersection that has a high degree of crashes, but there are other issues. So, for instance, if there's a steep slope going into an intersection, that may not be the appropriate place to put a red light camera. And I will tell you that there have been cases where some cameras have been removed because they're not an effective tool at reducing crashes. What we do know from the data is that the crashes go down, and that's the ultimate deciding factor is that's the goal is traffic safety. I'll also point out that these cameras are not universally profitable or they don't always pay for themselves. In 2011, Portland ended up took a loss of about $12 per citation from their red light system. The state still got paid because at the time that was the state assessment shared priority with was the primary payment. So the first dollar that came in under collections went to the state. If we didn't collect anything after the state's assessment was collected, then the city eats the loss.
Well, we're glad to hear that Representative Barker is doing his job.
Thank you. I hope that answered your question, Representative.
Please.
Yeah, of course. I think you said that in a local area, we do see a declining trend as a result of the cameras, so it's working in that sense. And you also indicated when we put it in, we do see a declining trend for safety purposes, reduced crashes. And then the final lesson to take from this is that we want to put these wherever out-of-town people are driving through. That's the last lesson I think I heard. Or more better put, out-of-state people. Yeah. Unsuspecting.
Put it on.
I don't believe Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz.
That was a facetious comment, I think.
I don't think Portland puts one on the I-5 bridge.
That's because just the speed limit's 13 miles per hour.
Yeah, because you need an opportunity to speed, too. So,
right. Right.
So with, I think I should stop.
All right. We interrupted your testimony. You may have had some other points. You don't have to finish them if you don't want to.
Vice Chair Benz did prompt me to expedite my testimony.
Thank you.
So I got to those points a little
faster. Let's get to Portland then.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Edwards on behalf of the City of Portland. I think many of the salient points have already been covered. We are also here today to voice our support for 2409, and there's a letter on the record from my City Council that was submitted at the Policy Committee. Actually, your senior economist requested that I come and provide some data on a bill that we passed in 2015 that allowed the City of Portland to pilot automated enforcement for speed on our urban high crash corridors. So it's a little bit of apples and oranges, but I think some of it will get to Vice Chair Benz's questions about the change in behavior that we're seeking. Mm-hmm. So House Bill 2621 created a pilot program within the City of Portland for urban high crash corridors that's defined as a roadway that has fatalities or serious crashes that were at least 25% above that of a like roadway. Just to give you a feel for how the programs are a little bit different. We just started rolling this out. The first corridor was Beaverton-Hillsdale Highway. Before the cameras were installed, we saw 1,417 vehicles a day traveling over 51 miles per hour on that roadway. And that is an area where you have children crossing to Robert Gray Middle School. After the installation of the cameras, we saw a 93% reduction initially. When we're looking at citations coming in, say, in October of 2016 versus January of 2017, saw about a 45% reduction overall in those citations issued. So it's that precipitous decline as people learn and augment their behavior on those roadways. And these are five-lane arterials where people can really pick up some speed. 122nd and Southeast Division are the two most recent places that we've installed these cameras, and we had a 30-day warning period. Today's the first day that actual citations will be issued to violators, so happy citation day. And we saw a 92% reduction on 122nd Avenue and a 71% reduction in speeding on Division. So it changes behaviors, and it has worked, been tremendously successful in Portland with this particular tool, and that's why we're excited and supportive of House Bill 2409.
Great. Other any questions for the panel? Thank you. Let me ask Mazin, are we getting the answers that you want vis-a-vis revenue issues?
Mr. Chair, I think we're starting to get some of the data that we can work with. Now, some of that, and your panel alluded to, some of the issues with this is not only the slice that the state government gets off the top, mm-hmm. but also, like in the case of the City of Portland, the City of Portland does all their work in a circuit court, which means anything that comes in, 50% state, 50% cities, and then there is all the other things depending on which citation officer does what and that kind of thing.
So you're saying there's no municipal court in Portland? There is no municipal court. I didn't know that.
No.
Okay.
No.
So if Portland goes that way also and adds, so that would even be more of money coming in through the state's way. So these are the things that we're trying to look at and find a good estimate for you that we can start with. We know it's not going to be right, but it's at least something that we can start with. I don't know how many this would go afterwards, as there's only nine, as Scott was saying. So we are learning the stuff that we'll probably be able to give you more answers.
Thank you. What question that occurs to me that is sort of a takeoff on the questions of Representative Benz is, do we have any data on whether there's an effect on behavior of the amount of the fine? Or the amount of the citation, I guess I should put it that way. Not necessarily the final amount of the fine, but the amount that's written on the citation that's said to be due. Do we have any data that would indicate that one number, bigger number, has more effect on changing behavior than a smaller number does, or not?
And of course, probably the chief could help, but depending on how fast some.
Well, the speed, of course, may have an effect on what the amount of the citation is, but let's suppose we change the amounts and just doubled them. Would that have a greater effect on behavior than leaving them where they are now? It really is an attempt to follow up on Representative Benz's question of what are the behavioral effects of this kind of intervention.
Well, Chair Barnhart and committee members, I think that it's twofold. One, it would be the recipient of the person receiving that citation. But on the other side, you have the individual officer who now has the task of issuing a citation for several hundred dollars to a person for that. And in the past, we've seen some hesitancy of officers wanting to issue citations for such a high amount.
Thank you.
With it's more reasonable, I think it's more likely to reach more people and actually issue more citations.
So the behavior we might influence might be the officer's behavior, not the driver's behavior.
Correct.
Thank you. That's a useful piece of information. Other questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. This is slightly off, but as a wild estimate of how many people in Portland are now aware of the possibility of receiving a citation as a result of this technology. Do you think 10% of the people now understand this could happen? I'm just curious because there's been a lot of discussion about tolling and using this kind of technique, and it appears to be something that people need to be accustomed to, and it looks like you're educating everybody up. The question is, how many?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, within the city of Portland, for this specific program, we're doing a lot of outreach before a camera ever goes in a particular neighborhood. We're doing warnings for 30 days before the citations are actually issued, and there's a robust signage system so that as folks are driving down, they have both the information and opportunity to change their behavior before they get into that enforcement area. And so I think those education components are part of the good faith that we put forward to make sure that it really is about changing behavior.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, if I may, the part of the requirement of utilizing red light technology is a robust public relations effort so that people are aware. If you look at and I can show you the reports of from the cities that submit the red light mandate that demonstrates what they've done to outreach the public. There's news releases. They cite newspaper stories. There's polling done to judge the public acceptance.
Right, but yeah. I appreciate that, and I can sure understand it. My question is, how many people in Portland now understand this? 10%? Have you educated all of the people in Portland? Everybody get it now, or you've just got a neighborhood by neighborhood, and we've got a understanding of about how many in Portland about this new technology?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, I wouldn't be able to say.
Do you have any data on that question?
Well, I mean, we are doing that's citywide is that we work with local
Smith
news
Warner
stations.
May have an answer.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure how you could quantify that. I can say, as somebody who lives in a neighborhood where there's a red light camera nearby, everybody who lives around there and is around it is quite aware of the fact that it is there and that it has these. And while I get what I think you are trying to get to, I'm not sure that there is a way really for the city to know exactly how much of the people who live there are aware of that.
So the follow-up.
Technology.
I'm not interested in exactness. How many out of the 10 gazillion neighborhoods in Portland, how many have this in them? Half?
No, this is a new program that's rolling out. So Beaverton Hills to Highway is in southwest Portland. 122nd and Division are in southeast. So there's a little bit of geographic equity there. As far as our red lights, we have 11 cameras on 10 11 cameras on 10 intersections, predominantly on, again, these sort of high crash areas.
And you're focusing on neighborhoods with scoff laws such as
clearly.
So
37th and Sandy.
Yeah, there's one on Sandy and Cesar Chavez, which would be 39th.
And which is the one she's probably aware of. Thank you. Is there anything else on this for this panel? Thank you so much. We very much appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2409 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2904. And I take it Representative Smith is on that one.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please. All right. Kyle, give us the quick, and let's see if we can get the... do we have people signed up for this one?
Yeah, I'm afraid we do.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Trying to be extremely brief.
For tomorrow?
Yes.
Thank you. Please, go ahead.
House Bill 2904, it expands the location qualification criteria for determining locations where a business firm can qualify for the long-term enterprise zone tax incentive. So that's a property tax incentive, and there is a secondary piece, a potential piece on the income tax side with approval of the governor. And it makes changes to the counties in which could become available to the long-term rural enterprise zone program. And there's some information in the background that helps explain how the change in the bill would expand those counties that's available. For brevity's sake, I won't go through that now.
Because I suspect we're about to hear it from Representative Smith.
Yes.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I represent District 57, which includes Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and Wasco County, Port of Morrow, Port of Umatilla, Port of Arlington, Biggs Junction, and the Port of the Dalles. Colleagues, I bring before you today House Bill 2904. As a little bit of background, there's two types of enterprise zones in Oregon. You've got the standard program that operates for 3 to 5 years, and then you have the long-term program that operates for 7 to 15 years. What I want to visit with you today about is the long-term program. At the Port of Morrow, it has been one of the most successful recruitment tools that they have in their toolbox. It's responsible for bringing projects such as data centers and food processors into Morrow County. This is a key point for everyone to understand. To be eligible for the long-term program, a county needs to meet several economic development triggers that sometimes are complicated. Those triggers include per capita income levels, unemployment rates, and net migration numbers. Here's the issue in Morrow County and in Wasco County. Their per capita income as a result, to be honest with you, of data center development and of temporary construction jobs coming into the county has raised the county's per capita income to a point where it now makes them ineligible for this program and ineligible to use this tool as part of their toolbox. And as a result, both Morrow County and Wasco County are scheduled to fall off the eligibility list to be eligible for the long-term program. What House Bill 2904 does is it simply changes the criteria from these multiple economic triggers, the three I mentioned, to simply stating that if a county is outside a metropolitan statistical area, you are considered rural and your enterprise zone also is eligible to be considered for long-term rural enterprise zone designation. I want to thank Business Oregon and Mr. Art Fish for assisting us in putting this language together and working with us over the summer and in the fall to help us craft this language. I also want to share with you that this language has been reviewed by our folks in the construction industry, primarily our labor folks, and they're very supportive of the work we're doing. It's important to know if you approve this piece of legislation that came out of our Economic Development Committee on a unanimous vote, it will not remove any current counties from the list of eligibility. It simply will allow Morrow and Wasco counties to remain on the list, and it will allow the local governments in Clatsop, Hood River, Gillum, and Tillamook counties to be eligible should they choose to go down this path. In terms of income impact to the state of Oregon, I would share with you this is primarily a property tax issue, although there might be a little bit of repercussion as it relates to the state school funding formula. But please keep in mind our local counties, cities, and ports who can comprise an enterprise zone have to agree and decide to participate in this program. In addition to that, your enterprise zone program manager has the ability to not enter into an agreement should a company not choose to be a good neighbor. So, Mr. Chair, that's what this legislation is about. We would ask for your support on this, and if it'd be appropriate, I'd like to ask Lisa Middlesdorf, the Director of Economic Development for the Port of Morrow, to share a few thoughts with you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you, Chair Bernhardt. I'm Lisa Middlesdorf. I am the Economic Development Director at the Port of Morrow. Been there for several years. If you're not familiar with the port, we're the second largest port in the state of Oregon. Ports' missions are to increase jobs, increase assessed values, increase wages, and create a better quality of life for our citizens. We think that we're doing that now, and the Enterprise Zone is a key tool for us to be able to continue doing that. It is just a fluke that we are going off of the ability to be eligible for a long-term rural enterprise zone. We have a situation where our wages have increased, and that drives the 150% requirement for a long-term enterprise zone to increase as well. Several of the jobs that are pushing that over the limit are temporary construction jobs that we're happy to have. They're coming and building wonderful facilities in our county, but at the end of the day, at the end of that 3 months or 8 months that they're there, they're going back to their homes and taking that income with them. So the city and the county, the city of Boardman and the county of Morrow, the income levels are still really lower in that county. It's just a way that we're not able to separate that income level. The Enterprise Zone is a great tool for Morrow County. We've had a lot of success with that. We're just getting started. I mean, it's really the tip of the iceberg for us to get started and really building our community and increasing the housing development and the quality of life for our citizens. We're working on workforce training and all kinds of other programs, and we really have the Enterprise Zone to thank for that. So please support this bill.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? It looks to me as though basically what we've said, what this bill does is it originally the bill said that we're dealing with chronically low income or chronically unemployed based on the most recent revised annual data available at the time the written agreement is executed, and we're adding to that separately areas that are outside of all metropolitan statistical areas. So in other words, we're removing the requirement that it be a low income or chronically unemployed area so long as we're outside the statistical area.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, part of the challenge we had was trying to find a correct definition. And so as we're working with Business Oregon on this, it appeared that the simplest and easiest approach to advance this concept and still assist the largest proportion of those economically stressed communities was just simply to come up with this new definition.
And let me ask it a different way. There's a high correlation, with the exception of dealing with temporary workers that skew all the numbers for you,
right,
between chronically low income or chronically unemployed and outside all metropolitan statistical areas. Is that a fair statement?
I think that is, yes, sir.
Okay, so what you're really doing is allowing for the fact that your numbers are temporarily skewed because of these high-paid temporary workers.
You are exactly correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Anything else? Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2904. Committee, we have completed our business and used our time. We'll see you tomorrow. With that, the committee is adjourned.